Good morning. Oh, good afternoon. It's already afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Upper Hume Primary Care Partnerships Conversation Hour. Are we about ready to roll, Bridie?
Yep, everyone from the waiting room is in.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting on lands of First Nations people, wherever our feet are on the soil, and I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. It's my great pleasure today to welcome two people as our conversationalists today who I think will bring a wealth of experience and understanding to the topic. So, first, Jenny O'Connor, who's the Mayor of Indigo Shire. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi, lots of
And
familiar faces.
and Peter Kenyon, who might also be familiar to some of you. Peter is the founder and director of the Bank of Ideas, and he's joining us from that new country called Western Australia. Welcome, Peter.
Great to be here. Great to be part of something in Indigo and that in the northeast Victoria. Yeah.
Terrific, thank you. I know you're
You
very
see
familiar
Kate
with us.
O'Toole there. Yes.
Yes. And I know you're very familiar with Indigo, and you've done some work with Voices for Indi, so you know the region well. So I feel like you're at home here. So thank you for joining us. What I thought we'd talk about today are these three interconnected notions of change and how we create change, and power and leadership, and how these three things need to sit with each other to enable change to happen. I want to start with just a couple of different people's perceptions of those connections and then ask Jenny and Peter to join the conversation. So Martin Luther King said that power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve a purpose, that it sits with that capacity to bring about change, whether that change is social, political, or economic. So it doesn't have to have that authoritarian ring to it. And Matthew Taylor from the RSA says that when governments or leaders are elected, they don't take power, but rather they create power. And he sees that way of creating power as the framework in with which change happens. And so he says that governments have the capacity to create power depending on how they govern, which I think speaks to some notions of trust as well, and we might need to get into there about how that power is created. But to be able to do both of things, to be able to create power and to bring about change, you need those leaders. So I want to talk about leadership to start with. And part of the reason we have both Jenny and Peter here is that Jenny has that experience of leadership in an elected position and has an understanding of the political side of leadership. And Peter's deeply grounded in community models of leadership. So I'm also interested in how those two things come together. Obviously, they're not mutually exclusive. People from community leadership move into political leadership, and political leaders come from community as well. So I'm not suggesting it's an either-or. So let's first talk about what sort of leader might be one that creates power rather than seeks to take power. So, Jenny, can you speak to us a little bit about ideas of leadership and qualities perhaps of good leaders?
Well, all of that's based on an assumption that I am a good leader, and I'd like to think that I can be. But yeah, it's something I strive for, and I don't necessarily always attain it, of course. I think I've been trying to think through what are the kind of things that I value as a leader. For me, it is about standing by your own values, really, and bringing people who share those values with you, and being able to communicate with people who don't necessarily share those values as well. And that can be very challenging. And so there are lots of challenges in the role I'm in at the moment, because of course it's very constrained by things that are way outside my control. And so one of the, if you like, frustrations for me as a leader is that I'm bound by legislation that's set by the state government around issues such as, say, planning, whereby we're required to accept planning, for example, of things that I don't necessarily agree with or think that the community wants. But because of the legislative requirements that I work within, the framework I work within, I don't have a choice around that. So there can be, in the role I'm in as a community, as a local government leader, there's a lot of limitations around leadership. And I guess that would apply for all elected leaders, wherever you sit in the political spectrum. You are actually constrained by things often way outside your control, which can be the party you belong to, it can be the legislation you work within, or even just the traditions of the system that you're in. So I think it's important to acknowledge that and not just think that because you're in a leadership role, you can just go about doing whatever you think you should, because often I think you can't. So that's just to put it out there. So then for me, there's a range of responsibilities within my role. One of them is that I'm the leader of the council, and that's a really interesting space for me because the elected councillors are a very disparate group of people. Politically, we go right across the spectrum. So I'm the leader of people who would vehemently disagree with me on political and values-based issues. But I represent them and I'm their voice. And that actually is quite challenging. I have to respect the fact that they don't agree with me and necessarily, nor do I agree with some of the decisions that are made. But I still have to represent that. And I think that's about being honest and saying, look, you know, this isn't necessarily my own personal view, but this is a decision of council and I have a responsibility to enact that. And I think in doing that, people come to accept, hopefully, that leadership does require compromise. And I think that can be really, really challenging when you watch leaders and you want them to really stand by everything that you hoped they'd give you. And they actually can't do that. And I feel that with leaders I've supported and gone, why are you not standing up for this thing, you know? And sometimes I can understand that, other times I can't. So I think, you know, I find myself in that position as well sometimes. Mm. Does that all make sense, what I'm saying?
It does. So it's about the context in which that leadership takes place needs to be understood, because somehow it sets the boundaries or the scope of what's possible, that that one has to work within that the context, those boundaries, that scope. And there isn't leadership of a single group. So there's the people who voted for you, there's the constituents, and there's your fellow councillors. Mm. That it's an amalgam of different forms of leadership, in a sense, that need to operate simultaneously.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. So there's team leadership, there's community leadership, there's being a spokesperson right across the board for very disparate and often opposing voices. Mm. Yeah. And that is really challenging. It is really challenging. Yeah. And as I said, I think sometimes I get it right, sometimes I probably don't. But I'm trying always to be mindful of that, of those differences within my community.
Terrific. Thanks, Jenny. Peter, from a community development, community leadership perspective, what sort of leaders do you look at that can create power to bring about change?
Well, I think, firstly, it's just I seem to have a lifetime working really in small rural communities. I'm passionate about helping communities reinvent themselves, building strong towns. That's really where I'm coming from. And when you look at what do those places look like, there are really two prominent characteristics that always come out. One is local leadership, the quality of that particular leadership. And the other is about mindset, a mindset that gets people focused on the future, gets people holding hands, gets people looking at the half full, not the half empty bit of the glass. And when you look at that leadership mindset, well, look, they're interwoven. And really the critical role of leadership is to inspire, to basically get others to step up and start playing their role. And so when it comes to looking at leadership from a community context, yes, we deal with, you know, and the importance of people like Jenny and the elected leadership, but there's also a whole pile of others, as Jenny's highlighted, that we call the civic leadership or the community leadership. And I suppose even the term leader kind of like has some problems when you start thinking about that. If you say to people in a small town, for example, who are your leaders? You can almost guarantee that at least 70% of the people that you're given as their names are male. At least 70% are probably in the 50 to 70 age group. And probably at least 70% you ascribe to a leader because of their position. They are a counsellor, or they are the doctor, or they are the school principal, or the bank manager, or a prominent family. But if you actually ask a different question, who makes things happen in the town? Interesting, 70% of the names you're given are women. 70% of the names are probably in that 40 to 50, 35 to 50 age group. And over 70% of them do it from passion, not from position. And so I'm one that says you do have formal leaders and you have this other group that I would call your community builder. I tend to use terms like community builders as opposed to community leaders, because that term leadership, I think we still have fairly narrow interpretations, because the type of leadership that's really needed to reinvent communities and to reposition them and to bounce back out of things like COVID-19 and bushfires and drought and everything else that Mother Nature has kind of like chucked at these communities requires representative leadership, requires a diversity of leadership. It really almost requires everyone to begin to see themselves within that context and what their contribution can actually be at. And therefore, it's very much a shared leadership kind of like concept, as opposed to what's often that elected. And in a sense, the role of leadership increasingly that we really value is almost leadership by stepping back, which is almost opposite to any concepts of power. You know, that our role is to open doors and windows for more people to step up. And if I've got a favorite term, is that leaders don't kind of like grow followers, they grow more leaders. And that whole idea that the role of leadership is to really inspire, open doors and windows for more people to begin to exercise what I prefer to call citizenship, really become much more engaged. If you look at most country towns, they could almost equate to a footy game. And that's where 30,000 people who need the exercise turn up to watch 36 players. And while we practice that type of leadership, I can assure you our communities are not going forward. So, yeah, the concept of leadership to me is really important, but it is one that's really about a leader kind of like being that servant of the people, that leadership by stepping back, that leadership of opening possibility, that leadership that inspires people to want to contribute their unique gifts to the citizenship that really makes those communities actually happen. We also need, as Jenny's indicated, you know, we do have formal leaders who are there, and how those two work together. And you can be both. I mean, I know a whole pile, and I'm sure Jenny fits into that category, who's both a civic leader in the traditional sense, but also a community builder, because that's probably why she's there in the first place, that she's passionate about community and passionate about making kind of like community that much better place and the role that leadership plays in it. So I think the topic you're looking at today is just so important. And how do we kind of like foster the type of leadership that really is needed, particularly as we move into a post-COVID-19, because we are definitely not going to go back to November, you know, 2019, how we function. And to me, the quality of leadership and the vision of leadership will really predetermine where many of our communities will be in that post-COVID kind of like situation. So that was a bit of a rambling kind of like introduction.
No, it's fantastic. I'm sorry. I'm feeling a bit like Josh Frieden.
You need to get water.
Thinking, yeah. Oh my goodness.
You need to come to WA, but
I'm not allowed in.
You all do.
There's no way you'll get in unless you're a footy team.
No, that's true. So there's this. So I love the idea of community builders as people who work from passion and not position. And yet we do need both, don't we?
You do.
So as you're speaking, I was sort of reminded of all the honours award, which really do reflect that description you gave of position, you know, gender and age, whereas the people that we know actually should be getting recognition are actually the ones that are there for all those opposite reasons. So so I'd like to talk a little bit more then about how can we take some of that community building concept and put it then into that political process that Jenny described so well as having a number of constraints wrapped around it that can somehow stifle some of those things like passion. Or do we step it aside and have our community builders operating without regard for that process? So, Jenny, do you want to just...
Well, I think certainly at Indigo, we have tried in this term to engage much more with community leaders, community grassroots community, if you like, movements, organisations, to support them, to play that role of supporting them to achieve their goals and aims. Again, we don't do that very well. You know, there's budget constraints. There's all sorts of, you know, I could go on all day about all the things that we can't do. But what we can do, I think, is say, you know, we want your ideas. We welcome that. And we have made a really concerted effort for a local government to really engage with community and collaborate. And everything we do, we put out. We're as transparent as we can be. And we ask for input. Again, you usually get the same people, and I think this is one of the things I've come to realise, going back to what Peter said. And Peter, I love the things you said. It was such a great way of talking about basically where I came from, which was community grassroots stuff into this kind of other role. And I think that there is a loss of grassroots engagement in the more official roles. We try and do that. Not as well as we could, and I think that's an evolving thing. I think the more people we get onto council, and this is my spruik today, is, you know, please put your hands up if you want to see this change, is that the more we get that kind of critical mass of councillors who think that way, the more it will change the processes we have, because we do drive the organisation. We put a council plan together when we're elected, and that sets the four-year plan for that term. That's how budgets are allocated. So, you know, if you've got councillors of, I don't mean homogenous and everyone thinks the same way. I think it's got to be really democratic, and I like the fact that we have such divergent views on some things. But I do think the more we get people of a similar kind of ideal around community engagement, whatever your views might be, then I think that's when we'll see real change. And at the moment, we're not the majority, and that makes it difficult. But I will also say that, and I don't know how we address this, but more and more I'm conscious of the fact that when people say, you know, the community of Yarkandandah, the community of Rutherglen, the community of Beechworth, you tend to be talking about the same group of people who see themselves as the voice of that community. And I think often they leave out voices that are not likely to get heard. So frankly, and I'm being frank, you know, the educated and relatively well-off professional people often aren't the voice. And the people who live with disability or who are marginalised or who are live in poverty are not the voice. And yet, you know, the decisions we make will inherently impact on them more than anybody else. So I'm really conscious of that. And I challenge that when people say to me, the community says. It's like, really? You know, you say and your ilk say, is that the whole community or is that your little cohort? And if you're confident enough to come along and tell me that you're the community, I reckon you're probably leaving out a lot of other people potentially. And I think we need to all remember that when we are in leadership positions, that it's very easy to fall into your peers. They become your community. You know, of course, you agree on stuff. You have the same goals. You're looking for the same outcomes. It's just, you know, I think that even in community grassroots politics, if you like, that happens there too. And I think that is just something we all need to be more mindful of.
So, Peter, in the small communities, small rural communities that you work with to develop up a community building approach, how do you ensure that those different voices come into that conversation and then have those conversations reflected in the political decision making that can have that those large impacts on groups within small rural communities?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Jenny has said, you know, community is very diverse, and it's very easy to just hear the squeaky wheels who are articulate and are able to often put their points of view. I think the first thing we've got to recognise, though, is people belong to multiple communities. I think that's one thing that it's easier to define geographic communities, but, you know, all of us, we belong to multiple geographic. I belong to a street community that I connect with. I belong to a neighbourhood community. I belong to a town community. But I also belong, you know, to the Frio Docker Footy Club, which is a community. I belong to a faith community. I belong to the local RSL kind of like club. I belong with a group of guys who go cycling every Saturday. It really is an excuse for a drinking community. And so there's a multitude of communities. And how do we hear that? And then there's a multitude of ages across that. It's very easy, again, to, you know, use traditional ways of listening to people's voices. You know, most communities think, you know, it's the guy out the front with the butcher's paper and everyone's sitting in rows kind of giving feedback and whatever, and that's how we're going to come up with a plan. Well, I can almost guarantee that who will be in the audience, the average age will be somewhere between 60 and 75. There will be hardly anyone probably under 25 in the audience. And we've assumed that that one night stand in a community hall holding, using what I call the meeting technique, is the way that we consult people. To me, I've increasingly, I don't think I've run a meeting now probably for 5 years. What I try to run is a what I call multiple conversations. My role now as a facilitator in community development is to host conversations, not run meetings. People don't respond in meetings. The more I can get people into groups of 4 to 6, much prefer that. Even when I've got 500 people, I'll break them up around tables into 4 and 6 and shuffle them around tables and whatever. That what I'm interested in is using conversation and so on, because I think that's the way. But secondly, to recognise if we want to hear those multiple voices, we're just going to be so much more creative in terms of how do we create that kind of like conversations with people. And some people can come to the physical, others, you know, it isn't online, others it's through gaming, others it's through competition. You know, there's a multitude of ways that, you know, I'm currently working with 10 drought towns across New South Wales and Queensland. And we've just been using a whole pile of ways over a 3-day period to kind of like listen to at least 60% of the community. And we're talking about communities around 2,500. So you're going to do that in 3 days. You've got to be creative how that, and there's no shortage of ways that we can do that. The other thing I think that comes to the heart of leadership and power that you're talking about is, again, what is the purpose of kind of like leadership when it comes to building community? And I think for the last 40, 50 years, we've developed probably a very bad model, and it's called we're there to service community. We're there to do things to and for people. We've somehow learned a little bit called with people, but that's usually saying we got three options. One's pink, one's yellow, and one's purple. Which color do you want? You know, that's not consulting. That's called asking for feedback. What we really need is to become much more creative doing it with people. But you know what's even more important? It's called of and by the people. And I'm increasingly seeing that our role is to do less of to and for, and even with, it's more about how do you create the space of and by the people? And how do you kind of like create that kind of like space? And that's where I think the community builder and the formal leader that we've talked about, I think, need to kind of like come together a lot more. And, you know, I say to local governments, Jenny, the role of local government is not the service community. No, it's not the it is to strengthen community. And there's a big difference between servicing and strengthening. Yeah. And how we go about it, I think, is an exercise in leadership and about this thing we call power and how we're prepared to share that and how we're willing to kind of like devolve that. You know, I think increasingly I'm saying to my own local government where I live here in Kalamunda, you know, your role needs to increasingly be doing less of this two and four, less of the pro, you know, I mean, COVID-19 is a great example. In our community, all the services collapsed because you couldn't deliver programs. People all retreated. They all closed up shop. You know what worked? It was called community, where people and neighbours started supporting each other, where the place-based groups started to reinvent the way that you actually connected. And so if there's one thing that's worked is community has worked, the way community's wrapped around itself and the way that community builders took that. And many of the people out of service land, you know, just couldn't function because the environment just wouldn't allow them to function as they did. And so the only way, what you do is you close up and you know, and I think that has been just an amazing illustration of how we need that formal and informal leadership to be much more working. And I know out of it, certainly the groups that I'm involved in locally, we've got a community hub group here, for example, we've just got a whole new partnership with our local government we never had prior to COVID, because COVID actually showed that we both had a role. Whereas before it was very unequal, that, you know, council had all the resources, council had all the programs, council were the ones who did everything two and four. And when they couldn't start delivering all that stuff and they actually needed new creative ways, conversation started. And our community is so much stronger because of COVID. It's really interesting. It's the silver lining that's come. And what's changed is the leadership dynamics and what people have interpreted as their role in building this stronger community that we all kind of like believe in.
Which comes back to that idea.
Again, that's a very rambly, like,
It comes back to that idea of mindset as well. And I want to come back to that work of hearing those multiple conversations and still having to act on something, because there's always a tension there. But before I do that, I want to just check in with Bridie to see if there are any questions or comments, and to really encourage all of you, if you want the opportunity of either posing a question or being part of the conversation, you just might have a comment that you want to make for Jenny or Peter. We'd be delighted to have you join in. And Bridie, is there anything that...
Just a couple of comments around managing leadership within the constraints of your own control, as Jenny talked about before, and also looking at the loudest voice might not be inclusive of all voices. And Jan made a comment about elected leaders and people who make things happen in community and how goals are interpreted and realised. Jan, did you want to talk more about that comment?
I will, Bridie. It's just that stuff about, we know that we have people who we look to for, I think, that governance role, and that the plans that are set are often the things that we look to actually guide our way. But I think the interpretation of what that goal actually means and how you actually get to the end product is often seen in multiple colours. As Peter said before, it's like, you know, there's not one colour. And I think that some of the relationship issues sort of happen because the interpretation is so different about what needs to happen and where we need to go and how we harness each other to actually achieve the same goal. And often what you find is that you see the separation in communities because they're all heading in a different direction, thinking that that's the goal, where in fact, you know, and that seems to sort of pull people apart and, I guess, weaken the approach to actually get to the end product. So for me, it comes back to really communication, I guess, and how that's done and how people are truly consulted and included in the solving of the problem. Like, you know, we know we've got problems. We've all got problems because, you know, we have to live with that every day, but it's how we get to the solution of that problem together rather than actually all finding a different way to get there. So, yeah.
Can I just throw in something that I think is quite positive, actually, and I will put it in the context of resourcing, because for small rural councils, that is the ongoing absolute frustration, is there are so many fantastic things I would love to see us be able to financially support, and we just don't have that kind of bucket of money available to us. But one of the things that I've been advocating for, and we've done it in a couple of towns already, and we're trying to, I want to see this rolled out across the Shire, is placemaking. And you actually go into the town and do exactly what we're talking about. You have lots of conversations in lots of different ways, and you actually get the community to decide for itself what is the direction it wants to take, what are the things they want to see happen, and how can we as a local government support that. That's actually a very resource intensive thing to do, you know, personnel wise and financially. And I've been advocating to the state government in terms of recovery from bushfires and COVID to say, give us the money to do placemaking so that we can go to our communities and you can tell us, and every community is different, and within those communities there's huge range of views, as we've said. But with that process, you do come up with something that is more what Jan's saying, where rather than us trying to interpret, like the community's telling us, this is really clearly what we want and where we need to go and what's going to help us recover and how we work together despite our differences. And that, I think it's a very powerful approach. And where we've seen that happen, we've had really positive outcomes. The frustration often, again, is then there's, you know, a bunch of a wish list, if you like, of things that the community says this would help us become sustainable and grow for the future, or whatever their goal is. And then we have to go and get grants to get those things happening, and that takes ages, and often we don't get what we need. And so resourcing is a genuine issue. And I think what I'm really hoping for is we get more partnership between community service groups, organisations who are themselves relatively well resourced, to work with local government around rolling out some of these goals of community, rather than, you know, local government having to fund it, because we just can't. I mean, that's the bottom line. We actually can't. And, you know, if you went back and said, okay, do you want us to put your rates up by 10% so we could achieve this? I'm pretty sure I know what the answer is. So, yeah, that's just, again, it's a reality check. It's one of the things when I got onto council, it was like, really? That's all, you know, like knocking back projects for $2,500 because we just don't have it in our budget is awful. It's really, it makes me really unhappy. And I think there's plenty of groups out there that do have $2,500, like the service clubs, like some of the, you know, community-based fundraisers. It's like, let's start harnessing some of that and actually all contribute, instead of saying, you know, you need to give us whatever it is for us to keep going, because we can't. And then it creates an us and them thing, or you know, frustration. So I think we need to change that as well. And I, in a way, I'm putting the responsibility back onto the community as well, saying, hey, what can you contribute as well, so that we can make this happen? Let's come up with those plans. So placemaking, to me, is a really powerful tool in that. And I'm hoping we can do more of that.
Jenny, I would go even further than that. I don't feel sorry for local government, because I think local government as a system has set themselves up for failure because of the way you function. And I think there are three things that need to kind of like change that local government, if they were really smart. The first is simply, I know very few local governments that have ever done an asset audit of their community, because they have lived on the tit of outside funding coming in to do everything. And I think outside funding is cream on the cake. What you've got to focus on is the cake. And the cake is, every community is incredibly asset rich. There are people assets, there are physical assets, there's business assets, there's story assets. There, you know, every community has far more assets than any one person knows. But we never think we've got to systematically map those. And we don't map to kind of like just discover, we map to find connections. And I tend to think, I say to communities, don't focus on where the resources are going to come to pay for this. Focus first on not what you need, but what you've got. It's like when you go shopping. You don't go shopping you don't go to the supermarket without a knowledge of what you already got in the cupboard. You know, I know I need tea, I know I need coffee, I don't need brown, I don't need that. We've asset mapped our kind of like, but we don't do that in community. And it just seems to me, I can count on one hand out of the 2,500 communities I've worked with who have ever done an asset map. They've all got a needs map. And that again is the second problem. That's what local government. We go to people and say, tell us what you need. Well, you don't know what you need until you first know what you got. And so we need a needs map, but even more important, we need that kind of like asset map. And thirdly, when we do the asset map, I think the role of leadership is not to kind of like say, tell us what you need, and then we have to somehow find the resources to do it. I run a thing called Big Idea Cards, and I used to go into communities, and I can tell you, I get thousands of big ideas. Everyone can tell me what needs to happen, but the implicit is, this is something that local council should be doing. And because councils are fundamentally into need maps, not into asset maps, they set themselves up. Now, I have now developed a card that says, what's my big idea for my community? And then halfway down, I've got another line that says, and I'm willing to contribute this to make that idea happen. Now, I tell you what, I get less big ideas. Probably it's been reduced by 40%, but boy, I get much better ideas because there's some commitment to help make it actually happen.
Yep.
And the interesting thing is a lot of those ideas, and many of them, as you've said, are in the placemaking area, don't even require money. They just need community to be smarter about how we use what we've already got. And you suddenly find, as we're now finding, people are stepping up and saying, well, I could do that, I can do that. But you know what? We don't know who we've got in our community, and people got this amazing range of gifts and assets. And so I would kind of like change that. And then the final thing that I think most local governments, and again, I can count on one hand how many who can produce this for me, is none of them have a leadership strategy. They all have a footpath strategy. They all have a tourism strategy. They all have a sewage strategy. They have a strategy for everything. Yet the most important ingredient for building a strong community is leadership. 20 years ago, the Keating government invited McKinsey and Co., the big consultancy group, to work out why certain regions and towns in Australia were doing well and others were doing backwards. And I always remember they gave them $1 million to do this, which 20 years ago was a lot of money. But at the end of it, they produced a report that was summarized really in one sentence. And it said, given the choice of giving a community $50 million or only $2 million, but helping to have 20 local leaders, we would go for the lesser amount of money and the 20 leaders. And that was this greatest endorsement that the critical thing is leadership and how we develop it. And yet most communities do not have a leadership strategy. And I don't mean we give money to the Alpine leadership course, that's part of it. But if we're going to develop leadership, can I tell you, start when kids are 5 and 6 years old. If you, leadership's about citizenship. I almost see the two almost equal each other now. Get kids at an early age starting to dream about how they make their community a better place. And I tell you, I've worked with groups of 7-year-olds who've designed how to place make better their town gone off and done it with no money, but because they think outside the box. In fact, they get rid of the box. And to me, through that, they develop leadership. So what are we doing, you know, in our schools? What are we doing with, you know, that woman who just is passionate about a certain area? How do we support her to kind of like find mentors who can help with that? How do we help her to go off to that course that's doing, you know, that to me is part of that. But we don't have a structure. We don't have a plan. And can I say, even hate to say it, we don't allocate a budget. You know, we have a staff development budget in local government, but we don't have a community development budget. How do we develop leadership? So I'm a little bit radical, I think, and whether that's because of the colour of my hair, that I've just seen so much stuff going on and saying to local government, well, please don't tell me, I don't feel sorry for you at all, because you know what? You've got to change. Start with assets, start with leadership development, start with not setting yourself up by doing, tell us what you need and we somehow are meant to kind of like respond. Tell us what it is that you think could make a difference and what are you going to do to kind of like help it make it all happen. I can remember when I started in community development, a guy once said to me, Peter, don't ever do anything that people can do for themselves, because you are, all you're doing is setting yourself up for being continually them being dependent on you having to do it. Your job is to open doors and windows for everyone to share their gifts and become true citizens in it. And so I suppose I'm coming from that position, and that's why the topic of leadership and power and all that is just so interesting to me, because I think we've got to be pretty radical today.
Mm. Well, I think there's an opportunity to be transformative and work within the system that we've got. I mean, as many of you know, my work has been about placemaking through the lens of older people in the Age Frontier Communities work, which is placemaking by another name. And it's interesting when you talk about money, the Victorian government over the last 10 or 11 years has allocated about just under $3 million to placemaking activities with a focus on rural communities to try to improve them for older people. So they've funded local governments $100,000 as well as provided a little bit of support to the Municipal Association of Victoria. There's very little outcome, very little evidence of where that money's gone. There's a couple of things that are still residual. Western Australia, over the same amount of time, allocated $700,000 to support local governments under the understanding that they had to work in a particular way. They gave them that support, that networking, gave them some resources. The whole state is now part of the Global Network for Age-Friendly Cities and sits around the table with the World Health Organization and has some beautiful examples of how that placemaking through an age-friendly lens has happened because the communities have come together and said, we can actually do this. And what council have had to do is had to hand over the power to say, sure, we'll support you. And the age-friendly world is full of lovely examples of where the contribution of local governments in all parts of the world has been to accept the risk that this is not being done within the formal structures that they would like, which is a big step for many local governments. So I think leadership training can happen and mindset training can happen until we die. So as well as teaching the kids, I'd be in semi-citizen centres as well, saying where are our leaders and how can we develop a sense of citizenship. But I do want to come back to this idea of bringing those multiple voices to the rub of where the work hits, where things have to happen, where decisions have to be made, and about how power, a power that can create and be creative in making those decisions can happen, that is recognised as a creative form of power in bringing about change. So I just wonder if either of you can speak about that, when all of that data, all of that information, all of that understanding, all of those multiple views have to come somewhere, whether it's within the community or whether it's within a council chamber, but somewhere there has to be some flux and movement and then a decision.
Look, I can say from a local government point of view, again, you know, I absolutely acknowledge that we don't do any of this very well, you know, for a range of reasons. But certainly at Indigo Shire, as I said before, we have, I would say every viewpoint is represented at the council table because we have such a divergent group of councillors. Now, you know, that means every decision is debated, and hopefully because you elected us, we represent you in that way. I think local government can be is very democratic in that sense. You know, people get on from all walks of life. You know, you don't have to be a career politician to end up being elected to council. So we have people from agriculture, we have professional people, we have women, we have, you know, we have a young woman with little kids, we have, you know, older retired ex-coppers, you know, all sorts of, and, you know, people that are from the National Party, from the Greens, you know, really as diverse as you can get. And therefore, my hope is that when we have to make decisions, and ultimately we do, you know, that all of those voices in our community are represented and the debate allows for that to happen. Because, that, you know, as clunky as that is, that's how democracy works. You know, you have to ultimately, someone has to make a decision mm-hmm. about where the money goes and is spent on which road, which service, which, and, you know, I love the idea of saying to a community, here's the money, there it is. You've got it, we'll just give you X numbers of dollars, you go and do what you like with it. There's no mechanism for us to do that under the current structures. Now, Peter, I totally agree with you that a lot of that is, you know, we've created our own, the rod for our own backs, if you like. But, you know, legislative change is not easy to bring about. Local Government Act changes are not easy to bring about. And some of that stuff is really very much tied to that. And some of it, as you say, is just sort of the way we've always done business and we can do it better. So I don't know if that answers Kathleen, but I think it is, you know, democracy is flawed, but it's still the best system we've got to date. And we work within the constraints of that. Yeah.
Peter?
Well, I probably hold, you're probably expecting a much more radical view, which I probably do. I increasingly don't believe in representative leadership any longer. It's almost like saying, you know, a woman with red hair represents the views of every other woman who has red hair. Well, you know, because I'm old and I'm, you know, in that 65 kind of like plus thing, I speak on behalf of every other person who's old and over 65. It's just not true at all. I just don't think anyone can represent. I tend to think our role is to try to develop, and our role is to try to open up that possibility for diverse views to be expressed, rather than me thinking that I can speak on behalf. You know, that whole idea of, well, let's have one young person on the group so they can speak on behalf of young people. It is just nonsense, because that young person can speak for himself or herself. How do we actually create an opportunity where 100 young people can actually speak for themselves, because within that there'll be such a diversity of views and whatever. And so I suppose I'm interested more in the process of how we can do it. A very interesting example, even from local government, was the city of Geraldton in Western Australia, who about 2 or 3 years ago decided to actually involve the community in determining how they spent their budget.
Yeah.
And they used the citizens' jury type of approach, where they basically, using a very democratic way of choosing people, you know, randomly, and people could put up their hand, and a whole pile of people came together and actually talked about, and then listened to people, people could make submissions, but actually advised council about how they could spend kind of like their money. I can remember when I headed the employment department in WA, towards the end of my time there, I came up with this idea saying, look, it's ridiculous. We go into a community and we deliver all these programs to them. You know what? We need to probably say to them, what is it from your community could actually work? You know, we give you 6, you know, lettuces and 4 carrots and 25 potatoes, you know, using that analogy, and 6 pieces of watermelon. What we're saying is, here's $50 million. You tell us what you want. And it may be, yes, we do want those 6 pieces of watermelon, but look, we don't want any potatoes, and we want this new thing called zucchini. And I suppose I'm much more into, how do we engage people in contributing to making real decisions about things that kind of like matter? And the whole idea of 7 or 10 or 12 people around a table, knowing and having everyone's opinion and thoughts and the expertise to do it, I just think it hasn't worked and it won't work. And I think we've got to increasingly see where local government, and not just being on local government, I think the business community got to be smarter about how we engage business. You know, most chambers of commerce, you know, 7 people turn up for something. You know, how do we get that diversity of age and gender and position? How do we see that the role of us as leaders is to create the opportunity for more and more people to contribute their input in terms of where we could do? And yes, it is more time consuming, but I think it can be a lot more fun. I think it can be a lot more cost effective. I think it does require people, and particularly Jenny, paid staff within council have got to increasingly move from being managers to leaders, in the sense that we're talking about today. We don't need more managers there, I can tell you. What we do need is more people who know how to exercise leadership. We need more facilitators who take on that title manager, but really see their role as opening doors and windows. So I dream of a new world forward, you know, and I'm really, every day I'm thankful for COVID-19, not for all the disasters and horrified, but there's some silver linings there that have forced us to kind of like say, we can't keep doing the same. You know, I'm reminded of Einstein's famous quote, you know, continuing to do the same thing, but expecting a different result was his definition of insanity. Mm. And we can't, the new world, and hope we don't go back to the old world, you know, or the old norm. We've got to kind of like think. And I think when it comes to leadership, and I'm, look, Jenny, I'm really so positive with people like you there and the way you're thinking. I think local government is the most critical institution we have in all of our rural communities, not just our big or small town, in all of them. And local government have got to take the lead, I think, on demonstrating. So across the civic and business and educational, you know, there's all those layers of leadership there that just need to be inspired about a new model of how we actually build citizenship, and where almost everyone feels at some stage they're going to exercise leadership by stepping up and contributing.
It's a really nice place to end. I do apologise. I have to leave this right now because I've got to go to another meeting. Thank you both so very much. I'm going to hand over to Bridie and she's going to help wrap things up. So thank you, Bridie. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much, Peter and Jenny. It was so great to have you both participate.
Pleasure.
And I'll be back next week, but Bridie will finish off now. So take care. Bye now.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Go well.
I just wanted to ask, Maria, you've made a couple of comments in the chat box around reiterating the importance of doing with and not just for community, and also about developing leadership through different means. Did you want to talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, hi, Bridie and everyone, and thank you. I guess I'm again very passionate about leadership and what community can do and how community can work with like local council and what can actually be achieved. And I've been following Peter for a very, very long time. I guess my experience, and this might be a little bit of Chatham House in here today, is that after 10 years of volunteering and trying to be a voice and a consumer representative for older people and vulnerable people, it's taken a long period of time, but with the persistence and perhaps doing the Alpine Valleys Community Leadership Program with so much support, it's opened up the door where I've got an opportunity to work with a national organisation. But in saying that, I feel the frustration with how do you continue to engage the voices, rural voices, and how you tap into some of these organisations and say, hey, you've got so many amazing people out there on the ground, and if you could just stop and listen to some of their messages and so forth. And I think change does come when we all work together, and it's got a one thing that I've always done and very mindful of, that it's always done very respectfully, that despite my frustrations at times, I am very mindful that I come in and I'm very, very respectful, and people's intent is really good, and it's genuine, but how you get that voice out, yeah.
Thanks, Maria. Margot has put a comment here about building on what both Jenny and Peter have been talking about looking at who is represented at the table and who is not at the table, and how do you know who's not at the table, and how do we get to hear from those people. Margot, did you want to talk about that a little bit more?
And I think, look, it's been great. Thanks, Jenny, and thanks, Peter. It's been, put me right back where I've worked for a very long time. And I think the important question there that I had was, okay, who isn't at the table? what do you think they'd say? But the really important one is, well, how do you know that? Why do you think that? You know, what's your experience of working or being or whatever with people? And there might be someone say, yeah, but my teenage son says this. Well, somebody else's teenage daughter might think something quite different. I just think that third question of how do you know that really opens up some great conversations.
Just,
why do you think that? You
know, one of the things we have tried to do again, because, yeah, of course, we're not every voice is at the table for sure, is we have advisory committees and they're made up of community people, consumers, who look at our policies and look at our, you know, strategies and feedback to us whether it meets their needs. So it might be an access committee for people with disability, or the environment committee around people that have got really concerns around, you know, environmental issues. Or but again, not everyone in that committee represents everybody. But I mean, at some point, you literally can. I mean, you can, Peter. In an ideal world, I could ask 16,000 people what their opinions are on every issue. But it's, I mean, there's got to be a practical reality to getting decisions made and things happening. Mm. So trying to get consumers and people representing their own interests to advise us is the way we try and do that. Again, it won't be perfect, but, you know, I know a lot of other councils don't do that. So it's an attempt on our part to try and make sure we do get other people's lenses put over things that we're doing at this sort of corporate level. And you know, it's not perfect, but I've learned a lot in doing that, of hearing the voices and raising awareness for me as a leader to say, hang on, I need to think about this. I need to keep that need in my mind, because I'm not a person that lives with a disability, for example. So it's important for me to be reminded that they're a very important part of our community whose voices are often not heard. And that was the point I was trying to make initially. So we've made attempts, imperfect as they are, but I and this work we do, I'm proud of as well. You know, we're, as a local government, a small rural community local government, I think we do try and do things outside the box. Yep. You know, just to try and defend myself a little bit, yep. Peter. I think we have.
No, I'm certainly not attacking you, and I think it's
but I do.
I suppose I'm one of those saying, let's not do things out the box. Let's get rid of the box.
Whereas I'm saying, box is there. We've got to work with it for now. I love your radical thinking. It meets my own values, but I'm also a pragmatist. You know, we've got to build the roads and the footpath. We've got to do that stuff.
And I accept all that. I suppose I'm just trying to push the thing. I suppose the answer always, you know, how do we make sure who isn't at the table is at the table? I think there's only one answer to that. We need a lot more tables. Secondly, I would, you know, I always say to local government, don't call it an advisory committee, call it a task group. Give it a role.
What do you call it?
A task team. Where, you know, we're not just seeking your advice, but we actually want you to do something, you know, and we actually devolve some of our power to them. And it may be with it some budget to say, you know what, here is a challenge, here is an opportunity, not just challenges, but I say also look at the half full bit. There's a whole pile of opportunities in our community. I mean, in our own council recently, they created an arts task team, for example, where they gave them a budget and said, you know what, we just need more public art here. And we devolved to them the responsibility to kind of like look at, hey, what have we got and how can we actually grow it? How can we use local people in growing all of that? And I tell you, some of the answers that have come out are phenomenal. And people did that for nothing, you know. They didn't need to be paid or anything. They did it for their community, because they're citizens and they wanted to give back and they had all this expertise with it. And I suppose I'm just trying to find practical ways that we kind of like try to do things a little bit different to get a better outcome. But the starting point is, it's about not asking who's not at the table. It's about how do we grow the number of tables, because we need more people involved in the process. So it's a lot of fun. I admire your leadership, Jenny. So please, it's not an attack on you.
I don't feel attacked. I shouldn't have said defend.
What I call this local government. And the way it's really attack on how we've done community development for the last 40 years, and it hasn't worked. And I think people are now saying, hang on, we need to kind of like reinvent how we build community. And I suppose that's what I'm hoping to contribute to.
I think that's a really important point, Peter, to probably I have to wrap this up. I'm really sorry, because I'm sure it's a really good conversation and it could go on for a long time. But that is a really good point about how we do community development and how we look to do it in the future, in from positions of leadership or organisations to support development of leadership in the communities. So I just want to say thank you both, Jenny and Peter, for the conversation that you've provided and the thought-provoking conversation that you've provided, and to everyone that's contributed as well. Just as we do at the end of all of the conversation hours, if everyone could pop into the chat box a couple of words about how they've found what they've got out of this conversation, that would be really great. And just to let you all know that the information about next week's conversation hour will come out very soon, but the title and topic for that is What Makes Documents Worth Preserving. And we'll be talking to Ashley Gifney from Burke Museum and Trevor Matthew from the Yak Historical Society. So thank you again to everyone for your contributions, particularly Ben and Peter.
Thank you, everyone.
And we'll see you at the next conversation hour.
Yeah, and Brody, can I say thank
you. Lovely to meet you, Peter.
Lovely to meet you, Jenny. And can I say to Kate, please give my best to your old man. We're very good friends. Kate's old man. So tell Tom I look forward to seeing him shortly. Go well.
No worries, Peter. Will do.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Okay. Yeah. Bye. I'll leave.